history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are seemingly ordinary Americans around you with extraordinary stories to tell. And we don't want to miss the opportunity to listen to those stories. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we sure learn a lot. We are educated, we are entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. 5 months ago, we marked the 75th anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Now this weekend marks the 75th anniversary of an event that isn't as well known, but claimed the lives of thousands of Americans and Filipinos, and was later declared a Japanese war crime. I'm referring, of course, to the infamous Bataan Death March, when approximately 75,000 American and Filipino troops who had been undersupplied, underfed, abandoned, and eventually surrendered to the Japanese were forced to make a 65-mile march with little to no food or water. A quarter of them died on the march. Thousands more would die in captivity that followed. We've heard from a few Bataan Death March survivors over the years on Hometown Heroes, but one voice we haven't heard from here is that of the first survivor I ever had the privilege of meeting, a gentleman by the name of Ben Ciccone. When I started interviewing veterans on television a dozen years ago, he was gracious enough to share some of his story, and I wish I knew then what I know now. I wish I knew how to ask better questions, because his story is absolutely amazing. Ben died in 2007, just before his 95th birthday. But I have pulled up a few of his memories to share with you today before we hear from other survivors of the Death March. Ciccone grew up in Salinas, California. He joined the California National Guard at age 17, and 12 years later, his tank company was called to active duty. He was in the Philippines when the Japanese launched their surprise attack on American positions, and after 4 months of fighting, with food and medicine dwindling and no help coming from American forces, he became part of a mass surrender on April 9th, 1942. Although you're going to hear him explain why he was actually on the death march longer than most were. For decades, this incredible ordeal of the death march and the 3 years of captivity that followed were things he just couldn't talk about, because really, who could possibly understand?
At first, when I come home, I had nothing else to talk about. It was a prison camp, you know, going 5 years. And then after a while, people started looking at me kind of funny. And my brother said, I wasn't talking much anymore. I said, well, everybody looks at me though I'm lying or something. And I just didn't care about talking about it. But a lot of days, I don't remember what happened on the march. And they say I was a survivor. And one of the longest, too, by the way, where I was caught. You see, that's why what you read in history, they say 55, 60 miles. Well, I went over 100 miles, and it took me 13 days, because on the wrong side of the island. I had my platoon. We were supposed to counterattack and then cut across and get on the easy road back, but I started back. The Japanese had artillery set up there, so I had no choice but to back up. When I got there, they started the march. I was running the tail end. That's why I was 13 days. Wow. It was most of them 5, 7, 8 days. And if I could have crossed the island, then I'd have been a lot better. And along the march, I don't know how many days we were on it, but he got us all out. He put us out in the field. Well, in comes a sharp. He graduated from the University of California, or Southern California. Born ways here. He called us every dirty, rotten name he could, some I didn't even know about. Made us take our hats off and sit out in that sun with no water and nothing for about 8, 9 hours. And he called us every dirty name. Well, we lost 10,000 men on the march and dead all over the place. But as far as food, we had a rice ball along the way. But you're talking about 2 weeks. I had another buddy, and we couldn't go any further, so we fell out. But lucky, I don't know how long I was there, 2 or 3 days. And finally, some guy striking the telephone wire, and he hit us, and of course, to get the hell out. back in the highway again. So we had to go. We got in the highway waiting for the stragglers and couldn't find out. It was only a couple of miles where we ended up, but there was about 50. And when we got in this place with a number of maggots and dead people, next morning there was only 8 alive and the rest were just dead. The last stop, we took a break. We were just dead tired. We were off the road. And there was a Filipino. I gave him a little water, but he died. So we flopped down. And then they said the Jap guards were covered up. So we just stayed there and played dead. Thank God the guy next to me was dead. They just hit us with a rifle and just kept on going.
What happened after that?
We finally got up and joined the trek again. You had to get out on the road. If they caught you, they would kill you.
And thousands upon thousands died, whether that way or otherwise. In fact, an accurate estimate of just how many died is still elusive because of the way it all unfolded. But you're facing the prospect of dying from starvation or from exhaustion, by cruelty at the hand of your captors, and in all likelihood, you're never going to see your wife and kids again.
My wife waited 3 years before she even knew I was alive. My wife had to go to work. And I had 2 children and a grandmother living with her. So my wife, lucky she's a college graduate, she got a job and then she worked in theater at nights and then she done some waitress work on Saturday night. She went to the Army. You know, I haven't got any money. My husband's as a prisoner of war. You know, oh, no, he's missing an accident. Well, we got to have something for your husband. You know, what a silly thing to tell my wife. So she had to go home and nobody gave her nothing. Took her 8 months before she got a dime. The Japanese put out a propaganda that I was being held. Then she heard the official word was just a month before I was liberated. I wasn't liberated, I liberated myself.
And we want to hear about the liberation, but before we get to that, I understand you were 174 pounds when you got to the Philippines, that on the march you got down to about half of that. But one of the things that helped you gain back a little bit of that weight after the march is that you actually befriended some of your captors?
I made friends. Matter of fact, my life was saved by this Nagano-san up there. I went to Japan to see him, and if it wasn't for him, like I tell you, in May, it took most of my men I could find. It took us 3 hours to walk about 100 yards to get on this truck. If you get on the truck, you'd go into detail. And they took about 300 of us. Then the next day we went on. They stopped the convoy. 150 went on ahead, and 150 of us stayed in this little town of Kalawan. And lucky, there's where we had a Japanese captain, professor at the University of Tokyo, spoke English. And he gives a talk that told us we fought a good war, we had to obey his laws, and there was no other way. And he would take care of us or feed us till we could go to war. He called in doctors, had the Filipinos bring us meat and food. We didn't have to do anything for 2 weeks if it wasn't for him. And then I got the job working in the kitchen, and this Nagano-san, the one up there, took a liking to me. He took care of me like I was a baby, I guess. Made give me sugar, smokes, and everything. So for 2 weeks, we didn't do anything. And if it wasn't for that, we'd all die.
So now,
let me tell you the rest. The 150 that went above us, only 8 survived that. We were lucky, that whole group, that 150 of us. We lost 7, and they would have died anyway. They were too sick to start with. But if it wasn't for them, and like I say, that Nagano-san, he helped save all our lives there, not only me. Then the story goes on for years.
Yeah, and you actually went and found him in Japan 8 years after the war and thanked him?
When I found out he was alive, we went to Tokyo, and I were at the Imperial Hotel. When I got downstairs, right in the early part of the evening, I spotted him with the stuff in his hands. He spotted me, put our arms around each other, and cried. In Japan now. That's something else.
Man, what a story. And you hinted at the story of your liberation. You said you liberated yourself. There were no rescuers. You just had to kind of figure out when it was safe to leave?
Somebody hollered, here's some planes circling and circling. Wondering what the hell he was doing and hoping they were Americans.
Yeah.
And finally, he made about 4 loops and he went over to prison camp, run into this mountain or dropped the food. That's when we actually knew that then the war was over. The day before, the sergeant came over, because I was a big wheel, and he came over, hey, Sergeant Coney. He says, nobody over there, Jap's quarters. I said, what do you mean nobody's there? There's nobody there at all. He said, does he got a radio? No, they took everything. Go over there, nobody there. So we talked, what are we going to do? I said, right now, we're going to do nothing. So about the second day, let's break in at the storeroom to see if it says D. I ain't breaking nothing. So on the third day, we decided the hell would I go in and at least get enough. We weren't eating rice anyway. That's another misconception. We were eating maize, chicken feet, unfit for human consumption, and some barley, uncooked. And finally, then when they dropped the food, you know, when these airplanes, we saw these parachutes open, and what happens? Now we're not only crying, I got attacked with malaria.
Oh, no.
You can't smell food. You don't eat 2-3 days. I don't care how hungry you are, because I had an attack of malaria.
So he couldn't eat for a few days, but he was able to taste freedom again, finally. Mr. Ciccone would later spend 30 years volunteering to help other veterans connect with the benefits they were due. He held on to diaries that had been kept by fellow prisoners, and he told me that he planned to have those diaries burned eventually because some of the material they contained was just too extreme for most of us to handle. Another example that even as much as some of these veterans do open up in later years, what they share with us here is only the tip of the iceberg. We're going to take a break here, but when we come back, more voices from the Bataan Death March, including one 96-year-old who has just written a book dedicated to those who died on the march, and the eerie reports he's received from friends in the Philippines about what they reportedly hear along the tragic trail where so many perished. If you'd like to learn more about Ben Ciccone and his prisoner of war experience, I have some links for you at hometownheroesradio.com, and we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes as we recognize the 75th anniversary of the infamous Bataan Death March by listening to stories from men who survived it. It just struck me how diverse the 4 men that we're hearing from today happen to be, but how similar their experience on the march turned out to be. We have one Italiano from California, a Kentucky native of Cherokee heritage, a native of New Mexico, a state that had more of its sons on the march than any other state, and finally, a Filipino who is still going strong at age 96 and has just published a book about some of his experiences. You'll find a link to that book at hometownheroesradio.com and on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. But for now, we're going back into the archives for one of the earliest editions of this program. In fact, it was only the 5th episode 10 years ago, And the recording quality may indicate as much, but the memories are pretty powerful. From Wild Bill Begley, who grew up in Hyden, Kentucky, spent much of his life in Squaw Valley, California, and passed away last year at the age of 94. He had joined the Army Air Corps and arrived at Clark Field in the Philippines not long before the war broke out. He would soon be fighting on foot with obsolete weapons, little protection, and eventually nothing in terms of food supplies. I do want to warn you that some of the candid descriptions you're going to hear from Wild Bill in a few minutes are pretty gruesome and really a shock to the system. But here's how Bill explained the situation in the days and weeks leading up to the death march.
Well, we had a saying, if it moves, eat it. If it stands still, we salute it. We ate monkeys and snakes, lizards, anything that walked, crawled, or flew, we ate. We were starving, actually. We ran out of food whenever General MacArthur sent word by General King for us to surrender. We didn't want to, none of us did, but that was the orders of the day. And we stacked up our rifles and went out to the road, and there's where the real terrible things happen. I was already in bad shape. I went from 180 pounds to about 110 approximately. And the reason is we didn't have any food. And like I said, if it moved, eat it. If it stood still, we always said salute it.
But then once you're on the march, you don't even have the opportunity to do that. If you get out of line, even if you stop to get a drink of water, you might get shot, you might get bayoneted, you might get decapitated. You saw all of those things happen, didn't you?
Yes, unfortunately, I witnessed all of that kind of stuff. I walked approximately about 100 miles, I suppose. It was a terrible ordeal because they didn't give us any rest. We couldn't get any water. I went on the march. I was on it about 10 days, approximately. And I didn't get any food, didn't get any water. Guys would drop out, and they'd try to help one another, and it was pitiful. If you stopped, they'd either shoot or bayonet you. They seemed to enjoy bayoneting more than anything else. The thing about it is they also got some women and children, unfortunately, they wouldn't let them out. They finally did. Quite a few of the Philippine soldiers, they slipped off into the forest, and if they got caught, they'd get shot, or bayoneted. So you had to be careful. We stopped at one place. I think it was the town of San Fernando. They lectured us in Japanese. They had an interpreter that would tell us what he's saying. They said you'd be shot and you'd be bayoneted. You had to do what they wanted to. And if you dared to get off the road, see a dirty ditch full of filthy water, a lot of guys would be desperate and they'd make a break for it. And they'd shoot them and bayonet them. It was pretty horrible. Later, when we made a stop, there's a bunch of Japanese officers who were drinking and enjoying themselves, and they taunt us. We did get to sit down. And every now and then they'd pick out 10 men, make them dig a hole in the ground. They would use their two-handed samurai sword, and they tried to first see if they could decapitate a guy with one lick.
And this is a living person,
yeah,
standing in this,
yeah,
hole they dug.
Yeah, they'd make you come to attention and they'd walk away.
Mm.
Then later they got tired of that because they got blood all over their uniforms and their equipment, so they decided to change it. And they lined us up about 10 again. You dig a hole, then they'd come around behind and shoot you in the back of the head. You'd fall in.
Mm.
That went on until they got tired. We walked day and night, no food, no water. It's a terrible ordeal. I remember in particular two incidents that still come to mind. There's a lady, we went through a little barrio, they call that's what a town. She had a little boy about 3 years old. The thing about it was he stuck his finger up and said, V for victory. When he did, the Japanese guard happened to be close by, and he bayoneted the little feller. Mm. And he raised him up, and he tried to fling him off his bayonet, and his mother screamed. She ran out there, and she tried to cover him, and the guard bayoneted her, and she died right there. And one other particular incident that was kind of bad was two chaplains were going across the bridge along with the rest of us. And one of them decided, well, this is too much. And he jumped. And the other chaplain ran around and tried to get to him. And when he did, the guard motioned him back and didn't want to get to him, but he insisted. So he shot him, and then he bayoneted him. They died holding hands.
Hmm. Unbelievably horrific things that you witnessed, and I know that you endured, too. I know that you estimate you were bayoneted yourself 30 times. You were wounded 5 times in the war. After the march was over, you were still a prisoner of war for another 3.5 years before you were liberated, wasting away to 68 pounds. By the time you were liberated, from 180 to 68, if you're listening at home and can just imagine what that must be like. I know it's the obvious answer to the question, did you ever think you were going to die, was yes. You probably had to think about that every day. But what was it that kept you going and that kept you believing that you might be able to make it home and marry and have a family and have the kind of life that you were fighting to preserve?
Well, I didn't have no fancy thoughts about marrying or anything like that. I worried whether or not I'd ever get through and survive. That was the main consideration. And under the circumstances, it was a pretty hard row. You wonder what made you keep going and whatnot. Well, later on, we got into some barracks and whatnot. I seen guys actually more or less commit suicide because they couldn't take it until they picked us up and sent us by ship to Mukden, Manchuria. There we got a little better consideration because they put us in, most of us, in the tool and die factory where they made the tools for machinery or plane parts or anything. Everybody, 100% of us, sabotage everything. And they had guards right over us, and we'd put filings in the oil and all kinds of stuff.
It had been years since I'd listened back to that interview with Bataan Death March survivor Wild Bill Begley, but the will to survive and to foil the enemy at every opportunity, even while wasting away to skin and bones, it leaves such a powerful impression. There was one more thought that Bill shared when I asked him why he spent decades traveling up and down California as part of a military honor guard for countless burials of veterans.
Well, when we got to O'Donnell, the first prisoner of war camp, the guys were dying so fast, it was terrible. The ones that were standing and able to walk and carry somebody, we'd get a door off of a hut and four of us get on it. Many times before we got to the hole in the ground where we'd have to throw them in there, maybe half of the guys, and I've seen as many as four of the stretcher bearers, would die en route. Mm. It was pretty tough.
It is just unbelievable to imagine how these courageous men persevered amidst those conditions. But every Death March survivor I've talked to echoes a similar storyline. And that includes those from New Mexico, which had more men on the march than any other state in the Union. And that includes those from New Mexico, which had more men on the march than any other state in the Union. One of them was a man named Julio Barella. And even before the march started, things had gotten pretty bleak for Julio. He and his fellow members of the 200th Coast Artillery in the Philippines were undersupplied, ill-equipped, and had no hope of reinforcements.
We don't surrender until we run out of everything. We were starving, eating weeds and stuff like that in order to survive. And that's where the death march started.
Now, when you started that march, you had no idea how long it was going to go. And you're already starving, right?
We started at death march pretty weak. We were pretty weak then because when we were fighting, we didn't have enough to eat. First thing, we were getting only two meals a day, and then they cut us to one meal a day. And then after that, we didn't have anything to eat. So,
what kept you going? How did you continue on? Because I'm sure a lot of guys were falling by the side and probably getting shot or bayoneted, and you were seeing guys fall left and right. What kept you going? How do you think you survived?
To survive? Well, we used to hunt. We used to eat weeds and stuff like that. Then a lot of them died with malaria, and a lot of them with diarrhea, according to what they eat, see. And part of them died in the death march, and then the other part died in the concentration camp.
Did you ever think that you were going to die?
I thought I was going to die, but I just got to where I didn't care. It was just like this. See, I used to worry a lot about my folks, about my mother. I used to worry every day. And one day I said to myself, "Why hell, I'm nothing but a doggone stupid. I'm not going to worry about them because they're better off than I am. They're not having as much trouble as I am having." And the other boys, they feel the same way. We got to where we forgot all about our folks and about the living life. Maybe we were just lucky because when they surrendered, a lot of them died of starvation. A lot of them, they didn't have anything to eat. They were weak, malaria, dysentery, and all that, a lot of disease. Well, we got to where we didn't care. We used to help the ones that couldn't walk. By the Japanese, the ones that couldn't walk, they shoot them. When a man lay down and he can't get up, why, they shoot him. So if they were punish you when you were in concentration camp, they punish me and they knock me down. And then I have in mind that if I try to stand up and get up, I won't be killed. So, see, that's a lesson the hard way.
I'll say that's a great way to put it, learning the hard way indeed. And every survivor of the death march that I've interviewed over the years has told me really the same thing that you just did. No one knows exactly how many people died on the march. I've seen estimates of around 10,000 or so. And who knows how many died later because of what they went through on the march. But I know that you Americans helped each other, and you got a lot of help from the Filipinos, who, from what I've seen statistically, outnumbered Americans on the march about 7-1. But all of you were not only marching 61 miles through deep layers of dust, you really didn't have any kind of nourishment. How bad was it? How bad in terms of what you had to eat and drink?
They make us wait 3 days before they could start giving us a bowl of rice, just how much they can grab on a bowl of rice. And that's when the death march starts. They start walking without water. And then in concentration camps, we were there starving all the time that we were in prison camp. We never did get anything much to eat. And they were Filipinos that would try to help us, give us food. They find out that Filipino tried to help POWs. They would shoot them or burn their kids, burn their homes. They act like they were not civilized. We never have a dream that we was going to survive. We never thought we was going to make it.
Do you remember how much you weighed before?
I weighed about 145, 150. I never been very heavy. But when I was liberated, I weighed 83 pounds.
Your liberation. You survived the march to Camp O'Donnell. You'd been in another infamous camp at Cabanatuan. They took you over to Japan on a hell ship. And in late August of 1945, the atomic bombs had been dropped, the war was coming to an end, and finally your camp at Niigata, Japan was liberated. What do you remember about that? What do you remember about tasting freedom again for the first time in more than 3.5 years?
We're very weak. Our mind was very weak, and our bodies very weak. We couldn't hardly do much work. We just hope and pray that someday the war will be over. We were working in a foundry. They never gave us a day off, so we noticed that it was a surprise to us that the Japanese said that we were going to get 3 days off, that we have to stay in camp. So we were anxious to hear the Japanese commander telling us that we have surrendered. And the American officer asked the Japanese, what happened? Nothing. You people won the war. The war is over. Now you people take over tonight. What the Japanese told the American commander, you take care of your prisoners, not to go out because they're going to get killed, because the Japanese don't like the American prisoners, and they're going to get killed if they go out of the camp. So better stay in the camp. So we stay there, you know, until the next day. Then the next day, they go three planes, and they drop us leaflets saying that if we would clear the area, they would drop packages.
So they dropped some leaflets. They said, get out of the way. We don't want to kill you with the food we want to drop for you. And then you finally got to go outside of the walls of that camp. You'd been living in, I would imagine, and you have described what would be a bleak, seemingly hopeless world for so long, only praying that you'd make it out alive. So not to be too cliched, but did it feel like a dream come true or a prayer answered when you got to come home? What did that feel like?
Well, we had plenty to eat. Every place we go, we just give us something to eat and stuff like that. And it was pretty hard to tell the whole story about it. And I don't know. And some people, the prisoners of war I have talked to, they feel the same way that I feel. They didn't want to talk about it. They got to where they didn't want to talk about it. That's funny. We do more talking now than we did before. We never did say anything because everywhere we go, we start asking us how many Japanese did we kill and all that. None.
Let me ask you this. How often do you think about the other prisoners of war who didn't get to come home? Do you ever think about that, about all the guys who died over there?
I dream more about them than I dream about my people, even today. Every day I remember about some of the prisoners.
Do you ever think that could have been you? Do you ever think about how you could have died there?
Yeah, surprises me that I made it. I sometimes don't even believe it. Being so long and I've getting old and all that, I sometimes don't believe it. I made it. I don't believe it. I went through all that.
It certainly defies reason. That was Julio Barella of New Mexico, which has several moving memorials to the Bataan Death March. There's a memorial march in Las Cruces every year, attended by thousands, including some survivors that show up year after year. There's a park there in Las Cruces featuring a statue of three men helping each other along with footprints in the concrete in front and behind those figures. And those prints were actually cast from the feet of Death March survivors. In Albuquerque, Bataan Park was a gathering place during the war for families whose loved ones were in captivity. And today, a monument there pays tribute to those who died on the march, as well as those who survived. In Albuquerque this weekend, a dozen survivors are gathering to mark the 75th anniversary, and one of them is 96-year-old Atilano David, a native of the Philippines. We'll hear some of his story and why he's decided to become a nonagenarian author when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting RVCountry.com.
honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to this special edition of Hometown Heroes, marking the 75th anniversary of the Bataan Death March. So far, we've heard the recollections of 3 men who survived the march. If you're in Albuquerque, New Mexico this weekend, you can meet up to a dozen of them, including a 96-year-old who just published a book about some of his experiences. I've got a link to that book, The End of the Trail, at hometownheroesradio.com and on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. But before we hear about the book and about his motivations, let's get a little bit of his perspective on the death march. His name is Atilano David. He had joined the U.S. Army in his native Philippines before war came to his homeland, and he was defending Bataan with the 33rd Infantry Division when Japanese forces attacked. Like all the other men we've heard from today, he quickly realized how overmatched they were.
We were grossly underprepared. Our rifles were too large for the Filipino. To sight the barrel, we had to put the heavy stock on our shoulders, and every time we fired, it bruised our shoulders. And most of the time, because the equipment came from World War I, some of them probably were not properly cleaned, or they were just obsolete. They exploded in our faces, and we had casualties. So the first engagement against the Japanese was a fiasco, because we had exploding bombs, rifles. Our machine gun and mortar shells did not explode. They were duds. So against a veteran army, and really from Nanking and from Manchuria, and most of our men were farmers and clerks, and some of us didn't even know how to handle a rifle. So we had to retreat from the beach defense to Agno River on North Luzon, while we didn't have any more air cover. We lost 350 scouts on the first engagement in Agno River, out of 800, because they, on horseback, they fought against tanks.
And these are the stories so many people are unaware of, and I'm so thankful we have you to clue us in a little bit. Were there rumblings of the surrender before it happened, before General King said, yep, this is it?
No, it was a total surprise. Well, most of us cried because we didn't want to surrender. And then when the order came to surrender, a lot of us were still fighting. In spite of the order to surrender, they were bombing us anyway. We were on the last defense on Mount Samat. We lost practically all of our 33rd Infantry was wiped out on Samat. And when I came to me to surrender, I had a choice of going into the mountains, because there was a rumor that we could go instead of surrendering. But we couldn't, because if we surrendered, anybody who surrendered was shot anyway. They had orders to kill all prisoners. As a matter of fact, there's a record in the books which says the first surrenderers were about 300 mixed U.S. Army and the Philippine Army. They were massacred, 300 of them, and they had surrendered.
I can't imagine what that feels like, to be in a situation where you have to make that decision. And you had family to worry about too, right?
Yes, I had a girlfriend who was waiting, and I didn't know where she was. She didn't know where I was. My father didn't even know I was in the Army, because I didn't tell him.
What do you think led you to decide what you decided, and how scary and frightening was that?
We decided to surrender because if we went to the mountains, we were blocked anyway, and we could be captured anyway. But when we surrendered, a lot of us went away to the hills, including Colonel Torpy, who became the guerrilla leader in Zambales Mountains. When I escaped from the death march, that's what I joined. When we first surrendered, we were lined up. Anybody found with Japanese money, paper money, or anything, or a sword, or as a souvenir, or anything that has a Japanese marking. The owner, the soldier who had it, was usually beheaded or beaten up. On my own, they tried to take my watch and my military ring, and I objected. And when I objected, the soldier hit me with the butt of his rifle in the belly and on my shins. So I fell down on my knees, and I was so angry I was going to retaliate when I got up. But a buddy mine held me back. He said, "Don't, Ahal, it's going to kill you, because they've done that." And when we gathered together in groups of 100, sometimes groups of 50, to start us on the march. On the march, even before I got too far from the site of surrender, I saw already bodies on the road, bayoneted. And these are not soldiers who were fighting, but they were sick, too sick to go on, with malaria, dysentery. That's when I began to lose hope. I said, "Oh, I'm going to die." Then in the next town, if I have a chance, I'll die trying to escape or escape. And I did that.
So how far into the march was that? How many days?
One day. So when I escaped, at first what my buddies were trying to do was, because I could not stand up anymore, and they could not carry me anymore. I had malaria and dysentery and a shrapnel wound, and I was fainting. So he said, "The next chance we have, you better go." When we saw the Japanese away from the guarding us, I tried to escape through the bushes, but they suddenly jerked me back, and they said, "I'll wait for another chance." At this point, I decided to die marching, because I was scared for some reason or other. No, I got scared. When they saw a gap a few miles afterwards, they pushed me through the bushes, and I fell across the bushes into a trench dug out by the Filipino occupants of the house by the road. And they covered me with banana leaves and bamboo leaves.
So you get pushed by your friends, who've already saved your life a couple times, it sounds like, by holding you back from retaliating and then telling you not to escape then. They push you into the bushes, you fall into this trench, and you're so weak you don't even know what to do, but these occupants of the house come down and cover you?
I was out for a while, because I was sick and thirsty and starving. When I woke up, I was already in the house, and they nursed me for 3 days. On the fourth day, I told them that I had to go, and they pointed me. They gave me a map where to join the rest of the group. Apparently, they had help other people. Many soldiers escaped through the same, so they knew where to go.
And, you know, there are so many great stories about the war in Europe, and we hear about, you know, the Corrie Ten Booms of the world, and the Anne Frank situation, or Oskar Schindler, and these people that protected some of the Jews. And we don't hear so many stories about the Pacific, but really, these people risked their lives to save yours. How did that make you feel? How indebted did you feel to those folks?
Lifetime. But when I came back, I was back into the MacArthur Liberation Army. I looked for them, but they had moved away already. I know their last names, De La Cruz, but up to now I've not been able to contact them.
And it sounds like you've spent some time trying.
This is the same time I was looking for my sweetheart, and because they had gone to the hills and I didn't know where. So it took me a while to finally give up. So when I finally found where she was home in Manila.
And a lot happened in between there. And I know you have learned a lot over the years. You're involved in the Bataan Corregidor Survivors Group, and you've met a lot of other people who survived the march, and you know how many died on the march. Is there any question in your mind that if you hadn't escaped at that point, that you would have survived or not? What do you think would have happened?
I would have died on the way, because on the way there were cattle cars where we were going to be confined. It was a cow car where only 100 could be, and they were jam-packed. They could not even sit down. I would have, I probably would have died of starvation and thirst on the way, or malaria or dysentery, because it was from where I escaped, it was another 30 miles.
And because of what we've heard from other voices today, we know exactly what those 30 miles were like. I happened to be in Albuquerque just last week, and I caught up with Mr. David, whose friends call him Al. I bought a copy of his book, The End of the Trail, and I sat down to ask him about why he decided to write it. I have to tell you, I was not prepared for a response that I can only describe as haunting.
I wanted to write about it because the road from Bataan to the concentration camp is about 64 miles, and 10,000 Filipinos and about 6,000 Americans died. And they are not buried in a cemetery. They are buried along the way. And at night, I hear from people around that march who still live there. They keep telling me that sometimes in midnight, you hear the moaning and the crying and the groaning of voices along the way. So that kept bugging me all the time. So I said, I'm going to write. But actually, I've not written about the death march yet. It will be the second book. I have written about my boyhood and the end of the trail where we surrendered after being literally assaulted brutally with 60 tons of bombs and strafing.
So this book brings you from your boyhood to where you guys were surrendered to the Japanese, and you're 96 years old and working on the sequel right now?
I am 96, and I'm busy on my second book about my life as an underground until MacArthur returned.
When's that one going to be out?
Probably about 6 months from now.
So this weekend will mark the 75th anniversary of the march. How do you want those who died to be remembered?
75 years later, I think I would like to remember the young people my age who died unnecessarily, because if Japan listened to the peace treaties and the wishes of the Japanese people, a million Filipinos would not have died. So I would like to remember it as a episode in the Philippine history which should not have happened. It's important for me because I lost a lot of friends my age. I also lost a brother-in-law who was killed by the Japanese brutally, and a lot of people suffering during the Japanese occupation. People who are happy, peace-loving people, suddenly they were in the middle of brutality and killings that were not necessary.
Why do you think you survived?
I must have a mission to accomplish. A lot of people ask the same question. And I think I survived because St. Peter is not ready for me yet.
Nope, he has more to write, and a legacy of so many countrymen, so many fellow soldiers who are no longer here and can't tell their own stories. I've mentioned that this April 9th is the 75th anniversary of the Bataan Death March, but April 9th has come to take on broader significance in the last 30 years as well. In 1987, President Ronald Reagan declared April 9th Former Prisoner of War Recognition Day. We've been fortunate enough to meet so many ex-POWs through this show over the years, and every single story serves as a powerful reminder from someone who was forced to endure the absence of freedom of just how valuable that freedom is. Such an extreme price was paid on the Bataan Peninsula 75 years ago, and we can never forget those who paid that price and those who continue to pay the price today. So with that, we conclude another edition of Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll honor our ex-prisoners of war in the most meaningful way by never losing sight of their sacrifice and never forgetting that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all a reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.